When did you get into the Big Apple?
I arrived yesterday, so I had a nice long rest.
You live outside of Boston?
Yeah, about 30 miles north or so.
Great, I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. I've certainly enjoyed your books, and it's a beautiful book, The Things They Carried. And normally, while I don't have the guest read from the book, I'd like to ask you to read a couple of things.
Oh, God, I'd love to.
Yeah,
I'd love to. In a way, that's what you want, that ultimately the book's got to speak for itself anyway. You can't talk people into liking it or disliking it. You just hope that you can get it into people's hands.
That's true, but at the same time, William Kennedy, the Bard of Albany, has a feeling that when the book comes out, you have to give it its due.
That's true.
So he likes to go and talk about his work and his books, and it helps to bring the book home in many respects.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anything that'll get a book into people's hands these days, you know, I think it's worth doing it.
We talk about the things they carry, tell me a little bit about you. I know you come from Minnesota. Tell me about your origins and what sort of motivation you might have had to become a writer.
Well, I grew up in a small prairie town down in the southwest corner of Minnesota and the Iowa-South Dakota border. And my dad was on the library board as I was growing up, and I remember him bringing home armfuls of books, virtually every day, and dumping them on my desk down in my bedroom, and not instructing me or ordering me to read, but letting the books be present. And I think it was through my dad's diligence that I became a reader. And after becoming a reader, it's just a natural step, I think, in a way, to wanting to be a writer. And wanting to be a writer grew and grew and grew within me until I had something to write about, which for me happened during the Vietnam War.
Well, a great many writers do compose about the things that are the most important and momentous events in their lifetime. Vance Bergeli, for example, wanted to write about the Second World War. He was a young man and wanted to write about the Second World War. He enlisted in the ambulance corps, and it wasn't close enough to the war, so he quit the ambulance corps and enlisted as a private and served in the South Pacific, and he did that. In fact, his first book was influenced by the war. And he did that because it was the event of his generation. Mm-hmm. And I would assume that you're a relatively young man in your early 40s, but the Vietnam War was certainly the event of your generation.
Oh, it sure was. I mean, it was an event I went to kicking and screaming. I hated that war from the beginning and did not want to become a soldier. I didn't want to die, but I sure didn't want to die in what seemed to me to be a wrong war. And if anything, the trauma of Vietnam, in my own case, it happened prior to going to the war. It wasn't that draft notice arrived, trying to decide, what do I do? On the one hand, my conscience and my intellect were telling me, don't go to this war. It's not the right thing to do. But on the other hand, I came, as I mentioned, from a small prairie town, a small prairie family with conventional values. My dad sold real estate, and my mother was a school teacher, and they'd both been in the Navy during World War II. And I can't say it was peer pressure or small-town pressure that sent me to the war. It was kind of internal pressure within myself. Or I was just afraid of being embarrassed is what it came down to, kind of imagining people sitting around in a small cafe on Main Street in Worthington, Minnesota, saying, did you hear what O'Brien did? The sissy went to Canada. And I had a girlfriend. I didn't want to have her think of me as a coward. I didn't want to leave her forever by going to, Canada or Sweden. And it was, I guess it boiled down to it. I valued my reputation more than I did my own conscience, which is a sad thing to say. But it's the truth. There's a line in the book, I was a coward. I went to Vietnam. And I hope now that 20 years later I'd have the maturity and good sense to, to listen a little more closely to my own intellect and my own conscience.
You got a draft notice while you were in college?
No, immediately after graduating, within a month after graduating.
I didn't. Well, they were drafting college age or college men.
Yeah, there was just after the graduate school deferment program had ended under Johnson, Lyndon Johnson. So as soon as I graduated, I was live bait, and they snatched me up quickly.
Well, certainly being opposed to the war was a popular thing to do in the 1960s and early 70s. But I wonder now, I've been reading a lot about Vietnam. I've read Stanley Karnauer's book about the Vietnam. Did you read that one?
Sure. Karnauer's book is a great book. Yeah.
PBS
history.
And I'm also reading John Delvecchio's new book about Cambodia. I can't remember the title. It's a great, great big book. And it was a terrible things happened after we left. Cambodia was just stripped by the what do they call the Khmer Rouge,
mm-hmm.
And I mean there was genocide. And Stanley Karnauer's book after the fall of South Vietnam and the communist takeover, life became brutal. It got to the point, according to Karnauer, that a straight pin was one of the most valuable commodities in the world for the Vietnamese. And I just wonder now, after it's all over, if perhaps it was a mistake not to have won that war.
Well, we could debate this to eternity, I suppose. I mean, for one thing, it's the whole question of how do you win the war? I mean, there we were for all those years, dropping tons and tons and tons of bombs on them. Problem was, I was just a foot soldier. I'm not a strategist or a great political thinker. I went over there as a kid, and what I saw was from a grunt's level. Just a regular old infantryman. We'd walk into a village, we'd search it. We might lose a man, we might not, and we'd leave it. And as soon as we left it, it reverted again to the enemy. No sense of accomplishment. Walk from place to place. You know, you could never find the enemy. In a way, everybody was the enemy. But, you know, you couldn't distinguish friend from foe. There were no battle lines, no ground was won and kept. I mean, how do you win a war like that? You don't. And, you know, it baffled our best military thinkers. It baffled the United States Army, the Marine Corps, the Air Force. It baffled the President, and to the point of resignation. And to say after the fact we should have won it, you know, seems a little too easy to me. On top of that, there are all these whole questions of, you know, remember back when all those predictions were made, you know, the dominoes will be toppling left and right, and there'll be a big bloodbath in Vietnam. I mean, there was no bloodbath in Vietnam. What happened in Cambodia had nothing, it was a consequence of, I mean, it was a consequence of our action in a way that we, by our bombing over there and so on, driving Sinuk out and so on, In a way, you know, the Vietnamese were the ones that stepped in. The North Vietnamese government, having won the war, stepped in and put an end to it. So, you know, it's not quite fair to say things would have been better if we'd have stayed over there and kept battling. You know, I kind of doubt it myself.
Well, I just you are probably right. I just wonder.
Who knows? I'm just a writer. I mean, I don't know much myself. You know, I just have my opinions like any citizen.
As do I. I mean, I don't know. I'm only speculating based on what I've read. But it seems to me that the lives of the people in Vietnam are rather dismal. But then I guess they weren't so good when we were there either.
I'd say they were one heck of a lot worse when we were there. That's not true for all of them, but it's certainly true for me. There are a lot of people alive that would probably be dead today. And I think they're a little happier. There were a lot of people who aren't orphans that would have been, a lot of widows, you know. War, seeing it from the ground level, none of us thought about big political issues or, you know, stopping communism. Once we were over there, it was a matter essentially of staying alive. I mean, if you were there for a week or two walking around, the most hawkish of us, those, you know, were most dedicated to the war. Even they quickly realized that we weren't accomplishing anything. You know, the officers realized it. Virtually everyone did on the ground level. And it became a matter of survival beyond anything else. And that's, I think, what I'm trying to write about. And I'm not writing in this book about big political stuff. I'm not aiming this book at liberals or at conservatives or anything in between. I'm aiming it at the human heart. And what I care about is that sense of imminent death, imminent peril that's with you for, in the case of Vietnam, for 365 days, and how to deal with it, how men did deal with it, sometimes with humor and sometimes with fantasy, you know, dreaming of their girlfriends back home and, you know, the things they'll be returning to. that to me, 20 years after the war is over now, what I really care about, what I write about, is the heart. Nothing more than that. And I hope the book just touches hearts.
That's what. And your characters are portrayed sympathetically, but there is still an image of the U.S. serviceman in Vietnam, which is not good. The popular image of a soldier who is brutal. I mean, reading your material, you can see that that's not necessarily the case. How did it happen, though, that this popular image of the serviceman developed?
Well, it happened because it's deserved. I mean,
it's deserved?
You bet your booties it's deserved. I mean, and it's not just in Americans. It's when you go to war, you're committing evil in the name of, you know, name of good, but you're still doing pretty terrible things. You're killing people, and you're bombing. You know, the city of Dresden was raised in a great cause, and Hiroshima was bombed. That's not to say the causes weren't justified and so on. They were. But nonetheless, the acts are evil acts. It's not nice to kill people. It's not nice to drop napalm on villages. It's a bad stuff. You compound that problem in Vietnam. As far as I could see, we compounded it by this problem of not being able to find the enemy. And so not only were we, you know, shooting at enemy soldiers in many cases, you know, we were trampling rice paddies, we were burning down villages, because we couldn't find the enemy. There was nothing to find, and a kind of frustration arose. And in a way, Vietnam itself became the enemy for the, you know, for the foot soldier. Not the VC, not the NVA, not the communists. Vietnam, in a way, was the enemy for those guys on the ground, a sense of rage and frustration and a sense of this kind of bitterness at how aimless everything was. So I'm not trying to knock American servicemen. I'm just saying that's a fact of war. And brutal things are done in war, and Americans, like any other nation that's going to go to war, are capable of doing some pretty brutal things. I did them, and my
you
fellow
did them?
Sure, my fellow soldiers did them. I'm talking about there are microscopic kinds of brutality, but brutality nonetheless. I write about for example, about an old man who was blind. And he came up to us one day at a well in his village. Nice old guy. And he took his bucket and he dunked it into the well and he began drawing up water and showering us. This guy's blind, but just throwing the water on us and smiling and bowing and basically kind of bathing us, you know, throwing the water over us. And I remember a big blonde American soldier named Tom picking up a carton of milk, you know, those cardboard cartons of milk, full. And for no reason, except who knows why, taking that carton of milk and from maybe 4 feet away, throwing it at that old guy, hitting him right square in the eye, and seeing the blood come out of the guy's eye. Well, that's not death. That's not napalm. That's just an instant of kind of microscopic brutality that's just etched in my memory. And I remember the old guy standing still for a second, kind of wavering, then smiling again, picking up the bucket, dumping it back into the well, and showering the next soldier. That's just a minor example of things you can see around you, you know, all the time over in Vietnam.
It's also reflective of a writer's eye. You began writing while you were in the service, didn't you?
I did, yes, I did.
But you didn't have a typewriter out in the field, though.
No, I didn't. No, I carried along a pad and some, you know, a few pencils and so on. And I can't say I was writing. I wasn't writing for publication. I wasn't really writing for communication. I was just writing, I think, in the beginning largely for a kind of, I guess, catharsis or a kind of self-communication, talking to myself the way I sometimes do, or even talking on paper to myself. And I sent in a few of these things from Vietnam. One was published in Playboy back in 1970 and a couple in newspapers. And which is how I began writing, really.
Were these the sketches that later appeared in If I Die in a Combat Zone?
Yes, right.
That was your first book.
My first book, yeah.
It was a nonfiction book. Sometimes, though, don't you find that images of events in the past are sharper in later years than they were at the time? Have you ever noticed that?
There's no doubt about it. In a way, what happens, I think, through memory, the war has been over for me for 20 years, and here I am having just written a new book about it. The sharpness of the new book compared to the old, the first you mentioned, If I Die, which was written almost 20 years ago, there's an amazing difference in clarity. of images and of sounds and of story, which just it stuns me now. I'm not sure what how you explain the process.
I can explain it, I think.
Oh, good. I hope
that's the Don Swaim theory.
Good.
I think at the time, there is so much clutter. There are so many images, so many noises and smells and people and so many things happening that it's hard to sort out the ones that aren't important and the ones that are. So over a period of time, you can look back and you know what events were most momentous in your life.
Does I think that's right. I think that is right. But I'm almost sure it is. You get more selective. Your memory, you know, sort of throws away the background noise, and you're left with some pretty stark images and sounds and memories that have that permanence, that sense of lastingness that you know good writing just requires.
Well, you escaped Vietnam unscathed.
Yeah, pretty much.
Outside of some perhaps burning in your heart.
A little burning in the heart, and I was wounded. And
you were wounded?
Yeah, it wasn't a major wound, but it was actually my first firefight that a hand grenade came sailing out and landed a few, you know, 7-8 feet away, and I just turned my back to it. I was carrying a radio at the time, one of these, you know, a radio from my captain, and I turned the radio actually took most of the shrapnel, and I got very little. It was enough to hurt and enough to teach me the lesson to, you know, stay away from hand grenades for the rest of the war. But I have to say, yeah, I didn't come back, you know, like with any of the predictable symptoms or the what we think of as the predictable or common symptoms of the war. You know, I had no suicidal impulses, no drug habits, no nightmares, no midnight sweats. I seemed to glide back from that war, landing, you know, back in the States and picking up my life where it was. And, you know, for years I'd kind of prided myself in a smug, almost arrogant way on how gracefully I'd made the transition from war to peace, thinking, well, you know, why are all these guys crying about it and whimpering about it? And it wasn't until writing this book, I think, that I began to realize that I'd had this natural vent all these years. That I'd been writing about the war in Vietnam. I wrote about it, and I've been writing about it ever since. I had a natural outlet for those, you know, those emotions down inside that a lot of guys didn't have. And I'm kind of curious now what would have, I mean, I'll never know, it's a purely hypothetical, of course, as to what kind of human being I'd be if it hadn't been for my writing. You know, I don't write for therapy or for catharsis, I write to get things, you know, to touch the reader. But nonetheless, it's a question that I'll have to live with for the rest of my life.
Well, you got out of the service, you went, let's see, you had graduated from college, so you were going to go on a scholarship to Harvard, isn't that right?
Right, I did. And I did. I spent about 6 years in graduate school there.
What did you study?
I studied government. I was planning to be a Henry Kissinger, only kind of a good Henry Kissinger. I wanted to take part in the nation's political life in some capacity. But while in grad school, I began writing pretty seriously. Not just about Vietnam, I mean about, you know, love stories and so on too, and my interest began turning to fiction in a serious way. And in the course of working both as a reporter at the Washington Post for a time and in grad school, I wrote my first three books.
Did you finish grad school?
Well, I didn't. I finished in the sense that I left. it became a choice in the end between a novel of mine called Going After Cacciato, which was about three quarters of the way through it, or the dissertation, when I was again about three quarters of the way through that. But I had to decide which to finish. And by that time, I knew that as a scholar, I was not going to cut it, and I was not going to cut it as a politician either. I just don't have that natural grace that a politician requires. And I also realized that in terms of my talents, I was clearly cut out to be a writer and not a statesman of any sort.
Well, let's talk about going after Cacciato. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are. Cacciato.
Cacciato. Cacciato. That's a town in Italy.
Is it? I didn't know that. I didn't. The name, actually, that's a guy's name in the book, and it means to be hunted or to be chased.
Yeah, a guy who walks from Vietnam to Paris. Tell me about this book. It's a wonderful book that combines elements of stark reality with fantasy.
Well, it's a book that's been you know, that's been good to me. what did one say about a book like this? It won the National Book Award back in 1979. Kind of a dark horse winner. That was a year John Cheever's collected stories had come out, and John Irving's The World According to Garp had been published. And, you know, the betting favorites were you know, Cheever and Irving. And I mean, I needed it. they didn't need it as badly as I did. Having won the award, my career, you know, I can't say I took off like a rocket ship or anything, but the book is still being read, and I'm very proud of it. I think it's a wonderful book. What else can you say about your own work? I love it.
Well, you have to say that about your own work. Well, you can either say that or say the work stinks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could be right in both instances. I mean, mm-hmm. I've written things that I look at and say, hey, that's really terrible. And I've written other things that, hey, this is really good. You have to get close to your work, and you have to appraise it in that way. And I think you have a right to be proud of it if you've done something. You've created a work of art.
I love the book, and I love the process of writing books, that even those that fail, and I've written a couple that have failed, there's something about that those 5 years or 6 years or in some cases 7 years that you dedicate to writing a book, that you won't give up, and you wouldn't give up, you wouldn't change, even knowing that it might be a failure, or is that the making of a thing, for me, is the pleasure. Having finished now the things they carry here, I'm on this long, you know, 2 month publicity tour on its behalf. It's interesting and fun to do this, but 10 years from now, what I'll look back on will be the making of that, of the new book, and not, you know, the its aftermath. The thing is done. You put it out in the world. You hope it'll last in a bookstore for a few months and on a library shelf for a few thousand years, and that someday, you know, in the year 2700, some high school student will pluck one of these books off the shelf, pick it up, and these characters will be alive again.
Yeah, I guess a writer, and many writers, do hope for immortality in that way. But there are other writers who don't. You know, books are often very perishable, mm-hmm. and they're written to be read and discarded. So many books that were very popular in the 19th century no longer read. Somebody was telling me, I'm not a literary historian at all, but there is an ephemeral nature to books, and I understand that at the time of Dickens, there were authors much more popular than Dickens and more successful than Dickens,
mm-hmm.
and yet Dickens is the one who has held up, yeah. and the others haven't.
That's what I think every writer hopes, that you know your work will last. You know the odds are against you, and you know that very few books will. But nonetheless, as a writer, you have to have a kind of faith. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it anymore. I'm not writing for my contemporaries alone. I'm not writing for any, you know, particular groups alone. I'm writing for the hope of the ages. Well, you do it and you hope. That's all you can do.
And you do it because I think you want to share your art with people, and you want to touch them and reach them in ways that you couldn't otherwise do.
Sure. I mean, we've been talking about Vietnam for a while, but my concerns now, 20 years after the war, have nothing really to do with Vietnam. It's the backdrop for some of these stories and so on, but nonetheless, my concern is to make something beautiful and to give pleasure, and to delight the reader in the ways that that art gives delight.
You're also a very funny writer. In the nuclear age, one of the funniest sections in nuclear age is when William turns the tables on the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist confesses to William. You know, those were wonderful, wonderful images. How did the nuclear age do, by the way?
Oh, it did awfully. It was one of my... I'm very proud of the book. No, I mean, I and six other people like it. but I like it. I think it's funny, and it touches me still. But, you know, it's in a way, I guess, it's like batting or something, or playing baseball. You just can't get a home run every time you go to bat. And after its you know, commercial failure, I just went back to spring training and worked for another 5 years. And the result now is the things they carried, which thank God is getting great reviews, and people seem to like it, which is wonderful.
Well, I certainly liked it, and it's very interesting because it's not what you would expect a novel to be, but it could be a novel or it could be a series of connected short stories. It's kind of hard to define this book because it's made up of so many little bits and pieces, but all interrelated.
Yeah, with the publisher and I had a tough problem with this, trying to decide what to call the book. I mean, it would be unfair to the reader, I think, to brand it as a novel, because it's not quite a novel. On the other hand, it would be unfair to me to brand it just as a book of stories, because I work so hard to connect the stories, you know, with recurring characters and recurring themes and echoes, and to run through the stories as this a made-up Tim character, Tim O'Brien character, reflecting back on the war and writing about the war. So in the end, we decided to call it a book, not to call it a book of stories or a novel, and just let it stand as a book.
Now, that might throw some people off. It is a fiction, and the narrator is a successful writer by the name of Tim O'Brien, but the book is not really autobiographical, is it?
Not in any deep sense. No, I drew on a few elements from my own life. You know, I went to Vietnam. I'm a writer.
Minnesota.
But most of the incident, virtually all of the incidents in the book are invented. In a way, I guess it was a way of inventing my own life or reinventing my own life. Beyond that, though, I wanted to find a means to pull the reader into to give the reader a sense of immediacy and urgency in this book that, you know, that a memoir might have or a piece of autobiography might have. And there's something about using one's own name when you're writing this stuff that forces you down inside, down into your belly. And although you're not writing, you're making things up, you're also drawing out emotions that I thought were long gone, were 20 years gone. To me, it feels like I know for me it's the most personal thing that I've ever written, even though it's almost all invented. I read some of these things aloud at colleges and so on, and it's tough to get through some of these things that my voice will crack, even though it's invented. It feels like the real me.
Well, that's what fiction can do, isn't it? More so than a memoir. I think that you can express the way we feel and what people do in fiction. You can take it a step further than, say, If I Die in a Combat Zone, because you can really get into the hearts and feelings of people in an imaginary way that still expresses the reality of humanity. Does that sound overblown?
Not at all. You just put your finger, I think, on why this book is written as it is. That sometimes things can be invented which are truer than the truth. There's a story, there's a little anecdote in the book about, here's a quick war story. Four guys go down a trail. A grenade sails out. One guy jumps on it, takes the blast, and saves his three buddies. Now, that's a hackneyed, melodramatic, stereotypical story that probably happened. It's probably true.
It happened in World War II movies in the 40s.
It probably happened in fact. But then you think, tell the same story but changing just a few items, and although this one couldn't have happened, so four guys go down a trail, a grenade sails out, one guy jumps on it, takes a blast, but it's a killer grenade, and everybody dies anyway. Afterward, though, one of the dead guys says, "Why'd you do that?" And the jumper says, "It's the story of my life, man." The dead are talking in this story, and it has a feel of Vietnam, the absurdity of it all. "Why'd you do that?" "The story of my life, man." That rings to me has a little more resonance than that kind of predictable, stereotypical story that we've all seen in Hollywood. It's, it's pure puffery, pure Hollywood. That one can invent, I think, with a little more and get closer to the truth of things than one can by just reporting on the world, you know, as it is. That's why I write fiction.
The opening chapter, can I call it a chapter?
Sure you can. You can call it anything you want.
This is really interesting and dramatic because over and over you describe the things that they carry into battle. And I was going to ask you if you could read a portion of, you know, just a paragraph or two. The broadcast doesn't have a... You've got so many sections of describing the... I'm just looking for the one I like best. I like them all, actually. Well, on page 13, that's
let's try it.
Really a good one.
For the most part, they carried themselves with poise, a kind of dignity. Now and then, however, there were times of panic, when they squealed or wanted to squeal but couldn't, when they twitched and made moaning sounds and covered their heads and said, "Dear Jesus," and flopped around on the earth and fired their weapons blindly and cringed and sobbed and begged for the noise to stop and went wild and made stupid promises to themselves and to God and to their mothers and fathers, hoping not to die. In different ways, it happened to all of them. Afterward, when the firing ended, they would blink and peek up. They would touch their bodies, feeling shame, then quickly hiding it. They would force themselves to stand, as if in slow motion, frame by frame, the world would take on the old logic. Absolute silence, then the wind, then sunlight, then voices. It was the burden of being alive. Awkwardly, after a firefight, the men would reassemble themselves, first in private, then in groups, becoming soldiers again. They would repair the leaks in their eyes. They would check for casualties, call in dust-offs, light cigarettes, try to smile, clear their throats and spit, and begin cleaning their weapons. After a time, someone would shake his hand and shake his head and say, "No lie, man, I almost wet my pants." And somebody else would laugh, which meant it was bad, yes, but that the guy had obviously not wet his pants. It wasn't that bad. And in any case, nobody would ever do such a thing and then go ahead and talk about it. They would squint into a dense, oppressive sunlight. For a few moments, perhaps, they'd fall silent, lighting a joint and tracking its passage from man to man, inhaling, holding in the humiliation. Scary stuff, one of them might say.
Oh, that's good. That's very good.
Kind of a weird, that's a weird passage. That one?
Did you do that?
Sure.
Pick
back.
13, I believe.
Let's see. 13, one more.
Yeah.
Right here?
Yeah.
Okay. The things they carried were determined to some extent by superstition. Lieutenant Jimmy Cross carried his good luck pebble. Dave Jensen carried a rabbit's foot. Norman Bowker, otherwise a very gentle person, carried a thumb that had been presented to him as a gift by Mitchell Sanders. The thumb was dark brown, rubbery to the touch, and weighed 4 ounces at most. It had been cut from a VC corpse, a boy of 15 or 16. They'd found him at the bottom of an irrigation ditch, badly burned, flies in his mouth and eyes. The boy wore black shorts and sandals. At the time of his death, he had been carrying a pouch of rice, a rifle, and 3 magazines of ammunition. "You want my opinion?" Mitchell Sanders said. "There's a definite moral here." Sanders put his hand on the dead boy's wrist. He was quiet for a time, as if counting a pulse. Then he patted the stomach, almost affectionately, and used Kiowa's hunting hatchet to remove the thumb. Henry Dobbins asked, "What's the moral?" Sanders wrapped the thumb in toilet paper and handed it across to Norman Bowker. There was no blood. Smiling, he kicked the boy's head, watched the flies scatter, and said, "The moral. Well, it's like that old TV show, Paladin, Have Gun, Will Travel." Henry Dobbins thought about it. "Yeah, well," he finally said, "I don't see no moral." "There it is, man. Have gun, will travel." Okay, one more try here. They carried all the emotional baggage of men who might die. Grief, terror, love, longing. These were intangibles, but the intangibles had their own mass and specific gravity. They had tangible weight. They carried shameful memories. They carried the common secret of cowardice barely restrained, the instinct to run, or freeze, or hide. And in many respects, this was the heaviest burden of all, for it could never be put down. It required perfect balance and perfect posture. They carried their reputations. They carried the soldier's greatest fear, which was the fear of blushing. Men killed and died because they were embarrassed not to. It was what had brought them to the war in the first place. Nothing positive, no dreams of glory or honor, just to avoid the blush of dishonor. They died so as not to die of embarrassment. They crawled into tunnels and walked point and advanced under fire. Each morning, despite the unknowns, they made their legs move. They endured. They kept humping. They did not submit to the obvious alternative, which was simply to close the eyes and fall. So easy, really. Go limp, tumble to the ground, let the muscles unwind, and not speak and not budge until your buddies picked you up and lifted you into a chopper that would roar and dip its nose and carry you off to the world. A mere matter of falling, yet no one ever fell. It was not courage, exactly. The object wasn't valor. Rather, they were too frightened to be cowards. They were too frightened to be cowards.
Very nice, Stan. Very nice.
That's a lot better.
Your hat, is that your trademark?
Yeah, that's my writing cap. And there's something about the Boston Red Sox and Tim O'Brien that get along great together that I can't write without this thing on for some reason. And it's also a way when I go on that people know who I am when I walk into buildings and they'll sort of look around looking for me. Who is the writer here?
So they have you on a major tour then, huh?
Yeah, it's a 64-day marathon tour.
Yeah,
I think this is day 10 or so.
You were going to go down to, as soon as I saw your itinerary here, you were going to hit some really small towns, though.
Oh, yeah, it's be a kind of a mix of big and small, both.
Yeah, here it is. But Oxford, Mississippi, well, of course,
University. That's where the University of Mississippi is. Yeah, first University of Mississippi is there. You get great audiences there. Some of those smaller places are actually bigger in terms of sales because there's a great...
Yeah, college towns.
They're college towns, exactly right, and you can sell a lot of books in college towns.
Yeah. Are you enjoying it?
I can't say I'm enjoying it, no. It's so hard it's so difficult to talk about a book that, you know, as I said to you earlier, all I hope is that, you know, you get the book into somebody's hands by doing this, and the book has to do its talking. There's nothing I can say that's going to, you know, help or hurt, I think. I just want to get the book into people's hands, and so it's well worth it. You know, if four people listen to you know, me in the course of a radio interview and go out and buy the book. Those four readers matter to me because I wouldn't have had them otherwise.
Not only that, those four readers represent four other readers each. You know, a book has a much longer reach than you think.
That's right.
A reader who purchases a book shares that book quite frequently, so it goes on and on.
Absolutely. So it matters to me. I mean, I don't like doing it, but I know that I think it's an honorable thing I'm doing. I don't feel bad doing it. And there are times when I meet new people. It is fun. But the real joy is when I watch a book move from a desk where it's being sold into somebody's hand and then out the door. That's the thrill.
Well, to conclude a little anecdote, Roy Blunt Jr., the humorist, was telling me he was in the neighborhood Barnes & Noble, and he had a new book out, and he stood there anonymously in the store waiting for someone to buy the book. And some people would go over and pick it up and look at it and put it back down. He stood there for hours, and he said he reached the conclusion that a watched book never sells.
You know, I had an experience like that yesterday. I was here in New York. I was in a bookstore, and I'm a shy guy. I just walked into the bookstore, and I wasn't going to say who I was and didn't. And I wanted to go in and sign books, and this was a Sunday, and the store was Books and Company, which is here in New York. And I went to the pile where my books were, and I just in front of me, a fellow picked it up and began thumbing through it. And my wife was with me, and she said, "Why don't you go over and offer to sign? If you'll buy it, you'll sign it." And I just didn't have the nerve. I just didn't do it. And I wish I were a little braver sometimes.
Oh, I've got a great story. I mentioned Vance Bergeli
a while
ago. He was up in New England where he had published his first book, and the local bookstore had stocked it, and he was in there. And willing and able to sign the books, and a woman picked up the book and looked at it. And he walked up to this woman, and he said, if you buy this book, I'm the author, and I'll autograph it for you. And she said, you'll what? He said, I'll inscribe it. I'll sign my name in it. And she said, all right, I'll buy it. But she said, I don't want you to write anything in the book. I'm buying this as a gift for a friend. If for me, you could sign it, but I buy this
not
as
for
a gift.
Friend. Oh, no. Oh, what a story. That is a great one. That's one of the adventures on the trail.
Tim, it was great talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for letting me be on your show.